Son Heung-min to score any time against Wolves? Incorrect. Marcus Rashford to score any time against Everton? Incorrect. Man City to win by 2 or 3 goals against Arsenal? Correct! And that means Will Hall was last week's winner of the BetBull Triple. Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of the Squawker Talk of Football podcast, sponsored by BetBull. My name is Jake Entwistle and I'm returning this week in place of the excellent Sam Long, and joining me are the same three guests. So unfortunately Sam is not joining us, but we do have Chief Football Writer at Squawker, Mohammed Butt. Welcome.
If you say so, mate.
Incorrect on Rashford.
I mean, yeah, but he scored twice. Well, he scored once yesterday, once with his own goal.
But that wasn't the... That was what, not
no,
what you picked,
I know.
Mo.
I know, so but, you know, I was kind of right, just on a sort of time delay.
The classic. That's how it works on the app, isn't it? Set your time delay.
That is not... I've been told that's not how it works on the app.
And it's definitely not. Ollie.
Hello.
Not the greatest debut shout.
Yeah, got that wrong.
Son's drought ends.
Yeah,
He was in incredible form, though, so... I can't blame you for that pick necessarily. And also, welcome back from me, because obviously I wasn't here last week, as I said. Good to have you on. And Will, as I said, the winner. That must feel great.
The way I look at it, when one of us wins, we all win. So from that perspective, it was a clean sweep.
Yes, and because we've changed it, where we'll each be doing one pick each, or three picks between three people, rather than trying to collate it all together, we've added that competitive edge. So now you can align yourself with a specific guest rather than Squawker itself, because it wasn't working when we were trying to do the triple, was it? So we've changed it a bit around. And as always, download the BetBull app. You can find the link in the description of the podcast if you're 18 plus and you do gamble aware. And then you can choose your fighter, as it were, I believe is what the kids say sometimes. But we're starting straight away with the best game of the decade. But it wasn't yesterday. Barcelona 0, Real Madrid 0 in an Un Clásico. The first goalless draw in that fixture since November 2002.
Yeah.
So we decided to do a big winners and losers from El Clásico 2019-20.
I mean, the biggest winner and loser is all of us who had to watch it.
Exactly. I was going to say the Squawker Talker podcast, because we've got a chat for 20 minutes about a 0-0. But given our expert skill set, we will be able to. And especially with Mohammed Butt on the podcast, I feel like it could go beyond 20 minutes.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm going to start with you. I won't give any preamble of stats because we might be weaving those in. Anyone that read your player ratings is probably preempting who your biggest loser of the evening was.
Yeah.
So without further ado...
Well, I mean, there were two outstanding candidates. I've gone for Luis Suarez because I think he is, even among the two outstanding candidates, which is Suarez and Rakitic, I thought he was even worse than Rakitic, because Rakitic played about as badly as you expect Rakitic could play, and it can happen. You know, he's not suited to the Barcelona-style play, whatever. Luis Suarez, on the other hand, utter trash. Now, this is the thing, right? It's not that he's a terrible footballer. By context, he's got 12 goals this season. You know, he's actually pretty good. But it's the way those goals have come. Most of them have come from him basically just standing still and shooting. His shooting technique is still impeccable. And it was telling, actually, the only good thing he did the entire night was his chest control, which is something he involves him just standing still and using his technique to work. Because he can still, when standing still, he's still amazing.
So he's still a good footballer.
Yeah. Yeah.
He'd be a complimentary walking footballer.
Yeah, he'd be the best walking footballer or one of the best in the world. Like, volley's amazing, passes, yeah, still pretty good. But as an actual force in the game, which you have to be as a centre forward, he was useless. And what was so worrying, I think, is sometimes he can play poorly, whatever. That's, you know, he's 33, approaching 33 now, it happens. Sometimes he can look erratic, whatever. You think, he's always fearless. That's the thing. He's always got this incredible passion about him. You know he's going to go at everyone. He's going to try it on with every defender. In the semi-final against Liverpool last year at Anfield, he wasn't playing well, but he kept running at Van Dijk. Kept getting rebuffed, but he kept trying to do Van Dijk. Right. Last night, there was at least 3 or 4 occasions where he was running at the Real Madrid defence and he stopped, turned around and passed it outwards. He didn't even try. He was afraid to take Ramos and Varane on. And this is a guy who, mind you, a year ago scored a hat-trick in this game. He's got 9 goals in 11 La Liga Clásicos. 9 and 11. He routinely destroys Real Madrid. It's one of, you know, he scored in his got an assist in his debut in a Clásico, scored the winner in his second Clásico. He's always done well against Real Madrid in big games.
And quite a good record for a terrible footballer.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, isn't it? It's like he's always had this sort of thing where he's been, he was fluctuated since he's been in decline the last couple of years. He's always had this thing where he fluctuates on the edge of looking useless, but you know that if there's always a big moment, it's going to come and he's going to take his chance because he's that kind of striker. Yesterday, there were big chances, there were big moments that came. He had a couple of shots on goal where he's thinking, okay, here we go. This is going to be it. He's going to make me look a fool. Didn't come. Utterly abysmal. Just kept turning the ball over. Was afraid to. And I can't get over the image of him turning around and running away from Ramos and Varane, because that's never happened before. And I think if his bullish, fearless attitude and approach to the game has gone, then that's where I think I came down on him even harder than I came down on Rakitic, was because if he can't even be fearless anymore, then what can he do? Like, against the rubbish teams, yeah, sure, you can trot him out and he might be able to grab a goal or two if he doesn't have to run too much because he's still got talent. But if he's now literally not even got the guts to run at defenders that, but, you know...
So I'll interject there, because that's like, that could be, that's quite a scathing sort of analysis to make of that situation. What if, and I, from the bits of the game that I was looking up and watching when covering the game, Barcelona are very lethargic as a team.
Yeah.
So when your striker is carrying the ball forward, if he's faced by two defenders, in most cases, trying to then beat them is as stupid as it is annoying to just turn back and pass it. Sometimes. I agree with what you're saying, like Suarez of old would try and weave through five defenders, etc. But what if Barcelona, by not giving him those supporting runs, because with Lionel Messi, for example, he is obviously magnificent, but there are times when in transition where he doesn't go up with the play, he stays, walks up, and then they turn around, pass it back to him, and then he dribbles through everyone.
Yeah.
So Suarez's decline or his lack of penetration when carrying the ball, is that potentially born out of the fact that Barcelona more than ever look dependent on someone else who is also 32?
Well, part of it is team chemistry. For instance, like if there was a reliable left winger that was flying down the wing, like if it was, let's say, Ousmane Dembele, maybe there would be more, Suarez have more inclination to just sort of hold it and pass it off. But the thing is, it wasn't that he was holding the ball waiting for people to catch up with him. That you can understand. Like, okay, fine, he's run ahead of the play. He can't run forward and whatever. But it wasn't, he was literally just straight up just turning around and passing it back to, not to Messi or to Griezmann, to midfielders. He was completely resetting the play and allowing Madrid to just, whatever short numbers that Barca managed to conjure, Madrid got back in numbers. And so Barca found it very hard to create anything. And then the few chances he did get that did came his way from crosses or what have you. There was that one move where Barca kept passing around the edge of Madrid box, and Vidal, I think it was in the end, or Messi, passed it to him. And he had a first-time shot on the from the left flank, could have easily curled it in or had a shot, and he ballooned it over the bar. You understand a player gets older, right, and he has to adjust his game. But the thing is, Suarez never has adjusted his game. That's the crazy thing about him. And look, this is a player who has been brilliant. He's got, I think, wait, let me just see what it is. In the last decade of league football, he has 233 league goals in the last decade. Only Messi and Cristiano Ronaldo have more than him. He's been a phenomenal force. He's been one of the best strikers, if not the best striker of the decade, right? There's no doubt about that. Even with his decline, he's still always managed to find a way to score goals. But I can't get over the fact that last night betrayed something in him that we've never seen before. The fact that he won't even try and take someone on. Even in his decline state, he will always try and make something happen. And he didn't do that last night, except when he was standing still, back to goal, chesting the ball down to opponents. Now, yeah, part of that is Barcelona weren't at their best. And the game plan was ridiculous because the coaches... Well, you know, I'll get onto that later. The coaches...
The coaches.
No. Yeah, so it's just... It was... Suarez was bafflingly bad. Like, impossibly bad. It was shocking.
The point I would make there is that you saying that he's betrayed his thing of not changing the game, but then also saying that he's a declining 33-year-old striker that still tries to tear around like a little kid even though his body won't allow him. Surely there's got to be a... Maybe yesterday was too far, but perhaps Suarez needs to stop playing like he used to play because he is no longer the
he's
same
also
player.
He's never had any competition really either, so he's pretty much played every single game since he joined five years ago.
That's the problem. And I mean,
and
really,
because Lionel Messi loves playing with him as well.
Yeah, no, they get on. Their passing combinations are fantastic. But the thing is, at some point you have to, and I think Suarez is incapable of changing his game, right? Because forget the fact that he doesn't claim to want to. I think if you take the aggression and the energy away from him, I don't think he could play like Cristiano Ronaldo, for example, has pared his game down to a fine point, right? Like he scores goals and that's about it. And I don't think Suarez has the sort of temperament or body type or even, you know, so much of his game is chaos, is controlled or semi-controlled chaos. And I don't think you need to have that. Mm. So that's fine. But what it is, and this is where again, it comes back to the manager, you have to rotate him and you know, he has to be understanding that, yes, I can't. But he wants to play every game, but he can't do that anymore. Yeah. And again, I would understand it as a player aging gracefully or understanding his age, his mortality, if he would then try and make it into something functional for the side. Like, okay, I can't run at Ramos and Varane, they're going to stop me. So slow, someone catch up with me and I'll pass to you. He just turns straight around.
But that's what I mean. I'd say that's born out of, like, you need your midfielders to make those runs.
Yeah, but there were players there. Griezmann was always to the side of him. Right. Not necessarily in front of him.
Just, from
he was awful. Just terrible.
2 out of 10 in the race.
It was generous. It could have been a one.
We'll go to a winner next, which, Ollie, I think you've picked a winner.
Yeah.
So correct me now if I've now got that wrong.
I've gone for a winner. I mean, it was a very difficult sort of pick because there weren't many out there on the pitch or off it. Obviously, the scenes after the game as well weren't great. The game itself wasn't great. I actually thought first half wasn't too bad. First 20 minutes, quite lively, quite end-to-end. And then second half was pretty much a non-event. Kind of simmered down quite a lot. But the first half, Ter Stegen had to be quite sharp to keep Barcelona in it. I think he made 4 saves in total. But there was 6 shots on target yesterday and 8 yellow cards, which sort of highlights the kind of game it was. You know, it was kind of like the Clasicos that we've seen throughout the past decade in terms of the feistiness and the aggressiveness without any of the attacking quality, really.
Without Messi or Ronaldo turning
exactly,
up.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. So, yeah, Ter Stegen, I mean, he basically did what you'd expect him to do. I don't think any of the saves were particularly out of the sort of world-class category that he sort of made regularly during his time at Barcelona. I think Mo will probably attest that in the Valverde era, he's probably been top three Barcelona player.
Top 3 or top 4, definitely.
So yeah, I mean, he did what he had to do, really. He was solid, if unspectacular, but that's what Barcelona needed from him. And I think as well, it was important for him to bounce back from that mistake against Sociedad when he parried the ball into Isak's path and conceded.
Because Opta tweeted out before the game that he'd actually made the most errors leading to goals in La Liga before that game, which was surprising because
he's so overworked.
And that often happens with that kind of keeper as well. The ball playing keepers often,
Cruyffing it into your own net or something like that.
I mean, he's also got two
trade-offs.
So yeah, exactly. It's the give and take. He's
got a net negative of minus one.
It's the trade-off, isn't it? If you have that kind of progressive goalkeeper, then, you know, you're kind of expecting him to make the odd mistake here and there. But what he gives the team in terms of building up play and things like that is crazy good on the ball.
And as well, one of the stats, again, that Opta tweeted out, I think it was first half. So you mentioned there wasn't many shots on target in the game at all. Mm. But Real Madrid actually produced 12 shots in the first half, which was the most in a Clasico.
To 3, I think, as well.
Yeah, they were genuinely on top in terms of general shot production at least, which was the most since 2003-04 by a Real Madrid team at Camp Nou.
Yeah, so, and it was a massive missed opportunity for them, I think. I mean, they didn't really build on that first half display. They were pretty much all over Barcelona. Barcelona camped in
at the Camp Nou.
Yeah, Real Madrid didn't really press home in the second half. They had that Bale goal that was disallowed, and he looked lively at times, but Benzema wasn't really on it. And it was a really big opportunity for Real, but they didn't really.
That should have been like Barca have got some big wins at the Bernabeu like last decade, like 6-2, 3-0 and whatever. That should have been a similar thing for Madrid last night. They should have walked away with like a 4-0 win because they weren't even particularly great, but they were so much better than Barcelona.
Yeah.
And I mean, with the exception of Piqué, Ter Stegen and Longley, really Barca were not even, and Frankie de Jong in spurts.
If your centre back pairing and your goalkeeper are your best players, then that's an indictment of.
Yeah, I was going to say. I think probably the best 3 players on the pitch were probably Ter Stegen, Piqué and Carvajal. I thought Carvajal was great for Real Madrid. Statistically, he was great anyway. He had 100% passing first half. I think it dropped down to 95. Mm. But he's winning headers, tackles. He was pretty much all over the place. Nearly scored as well. He had a good chance and he kind of fluffed his lines a little bit towards the end. But
Danny. Yeah,
him and Alba both had really good chances to score and both missed.
Yeah. It's just that Messi pass was the one moment of genuine quality, I think, when he just did the classic Messi pass.
And there's another Modric fed a pass second half, came on and didn't do much, but this one pass to put Bale through on goal was just this ridiculous outside of the foot first time thing. He just flinged it, I think, fully 30 yards. Through two Barcelona defenders into Gareth Bale, and if Bale had taken a better touch on his chest, he would have been one-on-one with Ter Stegen, might have scored. Mm. And then instead he just took a massive touch and went straight to his
chest. If he had any match fitness, he might have taken a better touch on his chest. Zizou.
Yeah, it's not a bad shout.
But I'll quickly jump in with my winner there, because we just spoke about the result and Mo mentioned that Real Madrid should have capitalised. I actually just highlighted Zidane as my sort of little mini winner, because he's the first manager ever, again, thanks to Opta for guiding us towards this, first manager ever to go five away clasicos without losing as Real Madrid manager. So for someone, as you said, there's been famous wins for Barcelona at the Bernabeu as well anyway, so maybe that sullies it a bit. But to win two and draw three of your visits to Camp Nou, especially given when Real Madrid didn't have him, I think, was it Lopetegui got
5-1?
That was 5-1. Yeah. So I'd say, even as you said, maybe he should have capitalised on Barcelona not being that great. Round of applause for Zinedine Zidane for not being beaten at Camp Nou yet. Manager,
as much as they should have won. Yeah, it's funny, the thing about Real Madrid in the last decade, obviously, Barca have done better at the Bernabeu than they have at Camp Nou, which is the weird thing. The Bernabeu, they've done much better than they have at Camp Nou. But yeah, I mean, you know, to go five games without losing at Camp Nou is impressive for Madrid, especially with the current state they are.
And the current state of which they are still joint top.
Yeah.
And they've got rid of that game out of the way. So, as you said, maybe they'll just lose at the Bernabeu in the future.
Mm. Yeah, it gives them an advantage on paper, you would say, in that they've not lost in their away leg of the Clásico.
So La Liga. And as well, quickly, why do you dig me out about Atletico Madrid never converting on my title-winning prediction?
I dig myself out as well, to be fair, because I thought they'd do really well as well.
He was projecting his own inadequacies onto you.
I think we were both inadequate in that regard.
Let's move on to someone that's completely and entirely adequate then. I've put some pressure on you there, Will. The final winner and or loser of this fixture, the cracker at Camp Nou.
Get ready for
it. Who are you going for?
Right, I've gone for Valverde as a loser. And I consider this a small mercy, because it means Mo doesn't have to talk about it.
Mo's got you on strings.
Maybe he will anyway.
I think we know the answer to that.
Bite your tongue.
My assessment of everything that went wrong for him is probably a bit more charitable than most would be, in that...
Oh, I have notes.
I think it's based on midfield matters, and he wasn't necessarily responsible for all of them, because I actually think the communication around the lineup undermined him and has put him in the firing line more so than might otherwise be the case. Going back to Luis Suarez, he had this to say after the game. He said that Barcelona had neither rhythm of play, nor personality, nor character, nothing. You can't play that way in front of the home crowd. And I think the reason they lacked rhythm is because Zidane dropped that midfield diamond, which was propped up by Casemiro, who I think got man of the match, and was able to stop Barcelona asserting any rhythm on the game. And rhythm is obviously something that Sergio Busquets provides in spades. And this is where the lineup situation becomes interesting, because for those who missed this pre-match, or even those who, like me, spent the evening quite confused over what actually was the reason he was not included in the lineup, I think I can make some sense out of it. So, firstly, Busquets was named in the lineup, but then it was announced he would be replaced by Rakitic during the space of time between the team sheets coming out and kickoff. So now everyone wants to know why he's dropped Busquets, who's a player Valverde's been accused of mistreating before. Initial reports from Catalonia Radio provided what seemed to be the answer, in saying that Busquets had turned up for the game feeling unwell. But then Valverde's assistant appeared to dispute these claims by saying on Spanish TV that it had been a mix-up with what lineup was given out before the game, and said that Busquets was fine and he was never going to start. The decision to not have him in the lineup was for technical reasons. So his attempt to clear up the confusion kind of backfired in that it enabled speculation that Barcelona's coaching staff had seen Zidane's tactical changes, mostly the energy and movement provided by Isco at the tip and Fede Valverde in midfield, with Casemiro sort of sweeping up behind, allowing him to sort of shuttle forward and be a bit more aggressive. We saw that Real Madrid were pressing very high in that first half. So the speculation suggested Barcelona had seen this, decided to drop Busquets because he's aging holding midfielder, who some posit is less mobile than other holding midfielders. That's obviously disputed. And then in the end, Valverde comes out and confirms post-match in his press conference that Busquets was in fact dropped due to illness. Donning the tinfoil hat for a second, I could see how it's possible both of these things are true, in the situation as to whether to play him, because if he's not quite 100%, was close. Valverde included him on the bench, and we saw him warming up in the second half. Valverde said they considered him an option to bring on later in the game. So I can see how it was a close call, and they may have just seen that diamond. I don't think Zidane's used this season.
He's used it a couple of times.
But this season or recently?
Yeah, like against Valencia.
Okay. Well, he's seen this lineup come out and then just thought, okay, that's kind of made what was a difficult decision a little bit more easy for me. But ultimately, what we know is that the midfield setup he did go with didn't work. He played Sergio Roberto, even Rakitic, played deepest, and Frenkie de Jong. And we not only know it didn't work because we saw it with our own eyes not working, but because Valverde's substitutions in the second half, when he brought Arturo Vidal on and sent Sergio Roberto to right back, not long after half time, showed that he didn't think it worked either. And I think he said in his post-match press conference as well that Real Madrid dominated them in the first half.
Unsurprisingly so, when they play four midfielders against your two, and yeah.
Three.
It was a flat 4-4-2. If you watched them in motion, Roberto was basically playing in front of Semedo. Griezmann was basically playing like a left midfielder in a 4-4-2. It was, you know, I don't know why you would ever put that up against Real Madrid in any form, let alone when they're playing a diamond. But anyway.
So Vidal comes on. He's interesting for another reason that I'll quickly explain in a second, and actually attempts more tackles than any Barcelona player during the period, during the entire game. And this was also during a period where Barcelona's possession share actually increased, so they were being more front-footed when you wouldn't necessarily expect a player to make more tackles in this kind of dynamic. And Suarez obviously said they lacked character. We tend to associate, rightly or wrongly, character with people making tackles, especially in a
passion.
Yeah, passion, that kind of thing.
Well, Duncan Ferguson, 37 tackles, most ever in a Premier League game. Energy, character.
So they appear to play a little bit better. I say a little bit because they were still very susceptible to Real Madrid's counterattacks in that second half, so it wasn't quite a tactical masterstroke. But it kind of undermines Valverde's decision to leave Vidal out of the lineup. In that they played a little bit better, and because previously, just before the game, ESPN reported that Vidal had left Tuesday's training early and had to be comforted by teammates after being told that he wasn't in the lineup. To me, that sounds strange, considering that he's only started one game recently, and that was the dead rubber in the Champions League against Inter, I believe.
It does sound like something Vidal would do, though, to be fair.
Exactly. But, and also, the other factor, I'm again donning the tinfoil hat a little bit, but it sounds like the kind of thing someone would do when they're trying to sort of lay the groundwork for a transfer move away.
Yeah.
He's been linked with
Inter recently. And the thing is as well, I mean, not for me to stack up for Valverde or anything, but it makes more sense to bring Vidal off the bench, because I think when you start him in games, he just sort of gets lost into the mire of the game because he's not the most technical player in the world. When he comes off the bench, he sort of asserts his own rhythm on the game, and the other players aren't quite ready. And plus, the other players are more tired then, so his burst of energy that he brings is actually a shock to the system, and it genuinely changes things. Happening against Inter as well, in the now he came on and Barca turned that around from a 1-0, they're 1-0 down, they won 2-1, and he got one of the assists. So it's, you know, there is definitely a use for him, but it's mostly off the bench, and I don't think he likes that. I think he wants to start.
Shot of adrenaline.
Conte famously called him a player he'd go to war with, so we know he likes him. Inter are linked. So in summation, I think it's not necessarily the decisions Valverde made were wrong. It's just that he's... Well, they were or they weren't, but I don't think he's not the loser. I'm not saying he's the loser because of those decisions.
I just think he's a loser.
They've put him in a position where he's inadvertently perpetuating this Busquets narrative where he's mistreating Busquets, and also might force Barcelona into the decision to sell Vidal, that they're not, they don't seem to be 100% sold on because of their midfield issues. The fact that Vidal, I've got his name wrong three times in this whole section.
Because you've got Valverde, Vidal, Fede Valverde.
Vidal is a player who's demonstrated his usefulness in coming off the bench and has character.
I mean, yeah, the thing with Vidal character. Is Carlos Alenia and Vidal are basically sort of vying for that fourth midfield spot, if you will. And I think for me, you've got to go with Alenia. You've got to back Alenia. He's young. He can really improve. He's got the kind of character Vidal has. But Valverde didn't bring Alenia on the bench, didn't bring Alenia on, just didn't bring Busquets on. You're just sort of like thinking, why not? They clearly needed Busquets. And the reason why I laugh at the technical thing, because I thought there was no way that could be true. Because if you think a team's going to press you, you don't take Busquets off. If there's one thing Busquets can still do, it's negotiate a press like nobody's business.
But I would have thought it's not to do with the press. It was to do with sort of getting past him if he's left as that lone figure.
Yeah,
if you've got Valverde running past and then Isco goes wide and it's like two people in the channels.
But that's why you're playing Rakitic. The whole point of Rakitic is, and the whole people, a lot of people have been saying this about when he plays a lot closer to Busquets and it's more protection for Busquets. And so if you're playing Vidal and Rakitic and Busquets, that's enough to both stop Madrid, but also more importantly, play your own game. When you take, if you take Busquets out for technical reasons, you're cutting your nose off to spite your face because there's no way you can then build the play. And you could just, and we saw this yesterday without Busquets at the base midfield. There's no, Barca can't pass the ball through midfield like they normally do. They can't build from the back. They couldn't negotiate Madrid's press for Toffee last night. And what the stupidest thing of all, of course, is the fact that they bought a player for 65 million who does the best Busquets impression in the world.
So that's what I was going to say. Yeah. When I changed the lineup on our little graphic beforehand, I put De Jong at number six.
Because that's what you do.
Because I just thought, oh, maybe it'll be quite nice to see him, as you said, do his Busquets impression in El Clasico.
And I think that's...
And I was even surprised to see...
He was playing on the left, wasn't he? A sort of... Shuttling,
which is where he plays, obviously, when Busquets plays.
No, that's
he
the
can
thing.
Do that.
Normally, he plays on the right. That's the thing. There's three positions in midfield. The worst one, his worst one by far, which he's still adjusting to the most, is the one on the left, where he has to play sort of the Iniesta role, which he can do. He has the skill set to do it, but he's not there yet. Nowhere near there yet. You play him on the right, he looks really comfortable. He sort of plays a sort of hybrid defensive midfielder, advancing midfielder. He really knows how to link with players there. You play him base in midfield, he looks perfectly natural. That's where he rose to promise in Ajax. So, that was one of the mistakes, starting Rakitic and Rabiot.
There's a trust issue there.
I don't know if it's a trust issue or not, because honestly, how could you not trust him? Again, a great example was Inter, like just a week ago. Barca was sort of meandering along. Vidal was in midfield with Rakitic. Rakitic was doing okay, not doing too brilliantly. Rakitic goes off for De Jong. Barca kick up several gears, start dominating Inter, and they score the winning goal. Mm. So it's the quality he brings in the middle of the field is ridiculous. I mean, that was the big thing. Rakitic pivot was, I think, the biggest mistake Valverde made, because obviously Suarez is whatever, you have to gamble on him because he's proven match winner on Suarez. So starting Rakitic pivot was a huge mistake. I mean, that alone decided the entire outcome of the game right there, and then I thought, oh, Madrid are going to win this. I was worried because he can't negotiate the press.
He didn't decide the outcome in the way that
you
thought.
Yeah, but he can't negotiate the press, Rakitic. He's always struggled with that. He's a straight line player. He's very good in a box to box role, playing alongside a pivot who can pass the ball. If you play him next to Frankie de Jong as a pivot, and you play Carlos Alenia as a third midfielder or even Vidal, that's a functional midfielder. That would have changed the entire makeup of the game. We might have even seen a Barcelona that played well. Who knows? I mean,
never!
Suarez might not have, might still have struggled.
And Valverde?
Well, yeah, that's the thing. In big games, it has been known to happen, but he made so many mistakes. And then he didn't bring Busquets on, took off Suarez, not Griezmann,
Come on.
He managed to neuter Lionel Messi and Frankie de Jong at the same time.
Lionel
that's
Messi,
kind of impressive.
Mr. Sitter.
Yeah, I know. It's like,
that's not Valverde's fault.
Well,
I say that literally biting my lip.
No.
Because obviously Messi's good.
Yes.
It was a weird one, though. That,
it was, yeah.
Just,
it's one that
kind
you'd
of stumbled
expect him
over
to
his own feet.
But that was, so to wrap up this section, as I said, that was sort of a huge anticlimax because Benzema was in good form. Messi is one goal away from 50 again. Yeah. And it's not like we've got some cool graphics prepared.
He's got one more shot at it, hasn't he?
This weekend coming up.
He's got one more shot. That will decide it all. But there you go. Some winners and losers from El Clasico.
Final mistake. Only brought Ansu on with 5 minutes to go.
Youngest player in 21st century in El Clasico history. At least some records were broken.
At least we had something to tweet.
Yeah. We are now moving on from the biggest fixture in club football, perhaps, to the biggest league in the world, TM. And we're going to be picking out three Premier League games that you need to watch this weekend, starting with Oliver Young-Miles. Let us know which one you've picked out. I think I already know. I do know. And tell us why people need to be watching it.
So the obvious one here is Chelsea Spurs, Mourinho's first game against Chelsea as a Spurs manager. His first game, actually, between these two was September 2004 in his first spot at Chelsea, which is when the park the bus phrase was coined, when he described Tottenham's performance. So there we go.
He described Tottenham's performance.
It was a 0-0. It was a 0-0. It was actually...
Or was it the West Ham one, like medieval football or something like that? Or?
Probably, yeah. Yeah, that sounds about right. So, yeah, no, that game is 0-0, and that's one of three 0-0s. Since then, sorry, there's been two 0-0. So it's a game with lots of goals, so everyone should watch it.
That's why you should watch it. Is there a particular player that you think is going to score lots of goals in this fixture? Because that's something that we may be able to put in our bet ball face-off.
So basically, I'm working my way around Spurs' attacking players here in terms of players to score. But there is, unlike Son and Wolves, there's actually a track record here with Dele Alli, who is a man that we all know is revitalised under Mourinho, even though he was quite good under Poch in the final few days.
Doesn't fit the narrative, Ollie.
Yeah, exactly.
Edit that out.
So yeah, no, Dele to score, I think, is a decent shout this week. If you look at the stats, which obviously we are.
Yes.
Seven games against Chelsea, he's got six goals. So it's his joint highest return against any club. He's also got six against Watford, which is less impressive. And that's in eight games as well. So in terms of strike rate, he's done better against Chelsea. And under Mourinho as well, obviously he's been in great form, as we touched upon. Three goals and three assists in five Premier League games. But I think the interesting stat here is in those games, across those five matches, he's registered 12 shots as well. So 2.4 per game. And in those matches, he's matched or bettered Harry Kane's number of attempts, except for the Burnley game where Kane returned to old Kane and had six shots.
Only six?
Yeah.
Old Kane is nine,
I mean, he's averaging two, yeah, but he's pretty much averaging two or three these days. Yeah. So Dele's matched or bettered Kane's number of shots in the other games there. I think positionally as well, we've seen him playing higher up. Mourinho's sort of stuck him back in this second striker role. This is another thing we sort of talked about last week, but basically Alli is making those runs off Kane and darting into the box a lot more. And I think we saw as well, the old Dele is starting to creep back in terms of the old
23-year-old
playground footballer type Dele we're seeing. Like, you know, when Eric Dier hit the post at the weekend, Dele sort of flicked the ball over the top, and it was the kind of impudent piece of skill that he's kind of stripped back from his game last couple of seasons. We're starting to see that coming back to the fore a little bit.
Premier League goal of the day this morning was his one against Crystal Palace, which was
outrageous. Oh, I don't think he's ever going to better that. No. The Man United one was very, very good. I think that's top three. But
there were shades of Dele Alli versus Crystal Palace when he scored that one.
Yeah.
The one thing about Dele Alli, though, especially against Chelsea, I seem to think that a lot of his goals are those little back post headers, which are almost not just to the Chelsea game. Yeah. It seems to be one of his lesser spoken about trademarks, based off the fact that he plays high up the pitch. But it always happens because little Dave Azpilicueta is not the biggest person, so if you can pull back onto him and you've got your way in front, he's unlikely, despite being one of the sort of the best 1v1 ground defenders, Azpilicueta always makes loads of tackles. That is the one area that is maybe cliched, but you can pick it out. And Eriksen playing in that sort of right number eight, deep crosses to the back post, Dele Alli, and with someone like Kepa in goal, who's not been that commanding and isn't that tall himself, the likeliness for that happens even greater, because Kepa might not feel safe enough to come out and claim those crosses. And Eriksen, if he does play, of course, that's still
probably right.
Daniel Levy quotes recently suggesting that, like, we're not scared to bid with our rivals, I think.
That was, you pretty much nailed it.
Yes.
So Man United, here we come.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing about that one, I mean, you're right to talk about those two headers, but I think if you think about Dele's sort of best moments in a Spurs shirt, a lot of them have come against Chelsea. Those two headers, obviously. probably not a best moment in terms of they lost the semi-final, but one of his another one of his top goals for Spurs was again from an Eriksen pass from 40 yards cross from like the middle of the pitch, which he sort of slid in and controlled a volley into the top corner, which is a great goal.
Is that the game then Matic scored?
Yeah,
that's screamer. Absolute screamer. Yeah.
Yeah, when Zuma couldn't believe it.
Where's he now?
And then the other two at Stamford Bridge when Spurs ended that hoodoo, and he scored a ridiculous one when the ball sort of, I think it was Dyer who pinged it 50 yards and he sort of controlled it and then lobbed it into the back of the net.
Danny's really good.
Yeah, I know. Talking about all of these brilliant goals that he's plucked out of the air, it's almost like he's one of those technically.
It is why he gets criticised. Because the goals and assists output he maintained. Mm. Think of all the Gerrard Scholes and Lampard comparisons that
came
up.
I thought you were just going to end it on Gerrard. You sounded like someone that has been scarred.
No. It was plastered across social media, his goal scoring rate compared to those three by the same age. Yeah. He was just leaving them in the dust. Obviously, there were loads of factors that explain that a little bit better.
But we can't go into those.
Yeah, okay.
But I was thinking, it's interesting you talk about Gerrard. I was thinking, why does he love playing against Chelsea so much? I think the fact that it's such an intense rivalry probably plays into that, because he's that kind of player that relishes big games, and he relishes also playing in that sort of atmosphere where it's, you know, very needle. Obviously, after he scored that goal against Chelsea at Stamford Bridge, the sort of defining image of that was him sort of cupping his ear to the fans.
So you've picked out a goal scoring midfielder to potentially decide this fixture, and it is one of Jose Mourinho's most famous goal scoring midfielders that he goes up against in the dugout. And again, we've spoken, maybe should have led with the fact that it is Mourinho versus Lampard. Lampard has obviously already played against Mourinho as a manager with Derby and won a penalty shootout at Old Trafford.
Yeah.
And this fixture in itself is, there's going to be loads of comparisons, isn't there? People, I think we're even preparing a video looking about Jose Mourinho's tactics and is Dele actually his Lampard, etc. There's obviously going to be lots of that narrative. But in essence, it is really interesting to see, obviously, the master meets the apprentice, all of those topics. And Chelsea going to the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium, there's a real chance for Lampard again to sort of get one over on his old master. Yeah. Can you see Chelsea getting anything from this game at all?
I think the big thing for them will be in midfield. I think if you look at the two teams, Spurs are probably better in attack. Defensively, maybe slightly better, but obviously Spurs have been weak and quite weak at the back this season. But I think in that midfield area, I suspect Chelsea, Lampard sort of chopped and changed recently. I think that's probably due to fixture congestion coming up. But that first choice midfield three of Jorginho, Kante and Kovacic is very, very strong. It's pretty much got everything you'd really want from a midfield three, especially now Kovacic is pushing on and actually chipping in with the odd goal here and there. So I think that's the main area that Chelsea will be looking at in terms of trying to get the better of Spurs, because conversely, that's an area that they've been really weak in. I think Jermaine Genius did a good tactical breakdown of it at the weekend. It was Dyer and Sissoko, centre midfield partnership, and they were very, very negative on the ball, playing the ball backwards a lot.
He killed them at the weekend.
Yeah. I mean, basically, the issue of that midfield partnership is, A, you don't have the expansive passing range to release the forwards, which is Spurs' best asset.
Give it back to Toby to do that, though.
Yeah. Yeah. Or, well, yeah, you can do, but you ideally want that from your
midfielders. No, that's what I'm saying. They're almost like, we can't do it.
Shifting Toby, can you do it as well? But yeah, and another thing, B, would be, you know, you'd suspect Sissoko, his best asset really is charging forward with the ball and causing chaos, but he hasn't seemed to want to do that in a midfield too. And I mean, the way to sort of solve that issue is play Ndombele if he's fit, because he brings both of those ball carrying abilities and passing abilities. But if it is that too, then that is an area where Chelsea can get some joy. I think,
and Chelsea have conceded 25 goals, Spurs 24, so as you said, the defences are both not incredible.
17 of Chelsea's have been away as well,
but they score a lot away as well, which is the thing. And Tammy Abraham, I think, and now I think Aubameyang and Vardy may have moved ahead of him recently, but was one of the top away scorers in the Premier League. So Stamford Bridge hasn't been a happy hunting ground for Lampard as manager. Obviously, the recent defeats against Bournemouth and West Ham. So I think it being away actually suits Chelsea massively. So if anyone does have predictions for this game...
Well, the only thing on that, though, is Mourinho's home record against former clubs is pretty much 100% very close to. 12 wins in 13 games, and the other one was a draw. So these are the kind of games he relishes. And obviously there's a little bit of needle coming into this as well with him and Lampard. Remember after the Man United game when Mourinho was a pundit on Sky and he sort of slated Mason Mount, and Lampard was taken aback a bit by that. And then I think it was in November, Jody Morris tweeted.
Oh, God, yeah.
Was it? He tweeted Jose.
No, Jose was like, I'm worried about Chelsea. Yeah.
No, Jose is still
and
worried.
Put, and he just put crying face, yeah.
And I think he tweeted that about the same time that Chelsea's official account
Harry Edwards,
top 14 table. Do you remember that?
No.
So Chelsea tweeted out, this is the top 14 table in the Premier League.
Man United.
Basically because Spurs are 14.
Oh, Spurs, yeah, of course.
And since then, Spurs have taken 12 points from 15 and Chelsea 3.
Yeah.
And if Spurs win this, they go ahead of Chelsea. Yeah. So, yeah.
It'll be interesting to see what happens. It's genuinely a huge game. That top four race that we were like, oh, it's done, is now Chelsea have been so poor in recent weeks that it's back open, but it's about seven teams going for it potentially. Harry Edwards actually mentioned that to me when they lost against Bournemouth. He said, oh, by the way, since Jody Morris tweeted this, we've lost five games or something like that. So one of those ones that the curse of Twitter and people remembering what you've tweeted. Do you have a score prediction then for this one? I'll put you on the spot.
2-1 Spurs.
2-1, right. We'll move on from the next game. We'll move on to the next game, rather. Mo, we'll go with you. Which game have you picked out?
Manchester City versus Leicester.
City.
Second versus third. City versus City. Champions versus runners
up. Carabao Cup semi-finalists.
Yeah.
Yes.
Both of them as well. Yeah, it's going to be such a fascinating game because obviously City need to get wins. They need to pick up points and get up the table because I think even if they're not going to win the title, which they're not going to win the title now, they have to finish second. I think it'll be too much of a slap in the face for them to fall from first to third, and they have to start picking up wins. And this is not the game that's going to happen, I don't think.
Ooh,
I'm going to be honest with you.
So why we should be watching it.
I mean, yeah, genuinely. I think Leicester, because you look at what Man United did to City, and if Man United had their wits about them, they would have won that by much more than they did.
I didn't think it was wits. It was just finishing.
Yeah, that wits finishing. Yeah,
wits finishing, sorry.
Yeah. Oh, no, but
continue.
If they had been a bit more clinical, they could have whomped City. They were cutting through them like butter, hot knife through butter in the first half. Leicester, I feel, have shown this season that they have no such profligacy issues.
Well done for getting that word right, because that's
a danger.
Yeah. They know how to. Thanks.
Jamie Vardy does.
Jamie Vardy in particular, and this is the thing: Jamie Vardy has got 4 in 10 in the league versus City, which you think, oh, that's not very good, which it isn't. But he's also got 10 goals in his last 10 games for Leicester. He's a man in form.
Well, the streak ended though. Against Norwich.
The streak ended, but start a new one, Jake. Time to start a new one. I think you look at the way he moves on the break, the way that they release him on the break. James Maddison's passing, obviously, is a big factor. City just looks so meh. You know, they've got great passing and play.
Why didn't they look meh against Arsenal though?
Wow, this is the thing, isn't it? I mean, look, this is the thing, City.
Because Arsenal are also meh.
I mean, no, look.
Since
the start of October, right? Man City have played 17 games. They've got 11 wins, 3 draws and 3 losses. Just 4 of those have been clean sheets. 4 of 17. Zagreb, Palace, Villa and Arsenal. Arsenal being the only reason. It's just City concede goals, right? Leicester.
So, no, they don't. I won't have it.
This is what Arsenal should have changed their manager before City. They could have nicked Arteta off them. They would have probably beat City. They don't have it this year. They don't know what's gone wrong, whether it's Guardiola's burning out. He's been there. It's his fourth year there. He's only ever been 4 years at one club, at Barcelona, and by his fourth year, he did look a bit burned out. And
he took a year out, didn't he?
Yeah, that was at Barcelona. So whether he's burned out, from managing City, the players have stopped functioning. And I do think, and this is the thing, you lose a player like Kompany, and they lost a player Kompany, and that you can replace or get by without, but they lost the leader Kompany. I think that's huge because he's such a big personality. He's such a big character in the local area, what he does, connecting with local Man City fans. I think if you lose that kind of leadership in the dressing room, I think more than losing the player himself, losing the leadership figure, I think is huge because I think he was such a motivating factor for City, and in the corresponding fixture last year.
Right. Yeah, there you go. Yeah. That's why my hand was raised.
yeah. He's the guy, he won the game. So not only did he play well in defence, although Ian Acho should have equalised, but he scored the winning goal. A stonking 35-yard thunderbolt.
Goal of the season, I think it was given in the end, just because of the
significance
narratively charged as well as power charged.
Yeah, I mean, it was like Rooney, the overhead kick Rooney did in 2010-11. It's a stonking great goal that also basically won the league title. Yeah. So it's, you know, it's a crazy, crazy loss to have company. I think so. Without City, just like they're unraveling to me. And I think United were really well placed to take advantage of that. And I think Leicester are too. I think it's the worst possible opponent at the worst possible time for City. You know, I'm a noted fan of Guardiola, but I think it looks clear to me he's lost his edge. He's lost his intensity. Part of that has been unlucky. I mean, they've had a horrible run of injuries.
And Arsenal stealing his right-hand man.
And this is the thing. This is where the wheels are really going to come off, because now Arsenal are going to nick his assistant. Who's he going to turn to now? Because, I mean, Arteta, whatever you want to say for him, he spent 5 years under Wenger, now 4 years under Pep. He was, how long was he a player for under Arteta? Under Moyes? So he's had pragmatism squared with Moyes. He's had idealism squared with Wenger. He's had sort of the mix of the two with Pep. So he's had the perfect experience. He's the kind
and
of perfect go-between.
His hairline hasn't shifted in all of it.
He's an implacable man.
That's the biggest testament to
his
ability.
I mean, unless Pep can lure Xabi Alonso from Real Sociedad, which Xabi Alonso said he's not leaving Real Sociedad. He's not going to leave. Nice. I mean, currently he's managing the B team, I think, or the youth team. So he said he's not leaving. So unless Pep can lure him...
What about Xavi? I can imagine someone like that's going to...
Xavi's too much of an idealist. This is the problem with him. Xabi Alonso has a sort of sense of realism. Xavi's talking like Cantona talks, like his head is in... Yeah, like Henri talk when he took over Monaco. It's like, that's great, but you have to actually know how to make that kind of football work. Like, it's not just good enough to talk about it. So I'm not sold on Xavi. I think Xavi would be a better sporting director than a coach. But anyway, City going to lose Arteta. I mean, I think it's all... All but
well,
agreed.
Yeah,
we're
waiting for. So we told Sam for the podcast, and I wanted it to happen, but it's yet to. He has to run in and disturb the podcast if he is appointed. But because we haven't had a knock, you know that while we're recording, we still don't know if it is confirmed.
Yeah, but basically, he's not going to be there probably at the weekend. So he's perhaps going to be assistant-less against. So the wheels are just coming off City. Everything's going wrong for them. And Leicester are so good on the break. Leicester have won 10 wins in the last 11 games since the Liverpool defeat. They're just, you know, they're
always fine. I don't know, based on what Man United did to Man City, whether, because Rodgers has even whipped out his little diamond as well recently, a 4-4-2.
Ian Acho's
come into form.
But then he did hook him after all,
yes.
30 minutes.
But I don't know if that was to do with, it didn't really match up against the 4-2-3-1, and also
and was
didn't
it because
he
just, yeah, he scored that, tried to score when
they were injured.
The
so I think it was a bit like, we'll take you out of the firing line. But I could see them sort of rerunning that against Man City and just going, channel balls.
What do you think?
This is what I'm saying. Potentially, it could. I don't know what they're going to do.
Because
when company scored that winner, so this was another good point I was going to make. Leicester were playing really well in that game, and obviously that was under Rodgers, because it's sort of 2019.
I think both teams are in a
different
stage now, aren't they? And I think the big thing that Rodgers has done at Leicester is he's transformed them from being solely a counter-attacking team to being a possession-based side that can dominate and dictate play. And I wonder whether this weekend he'll just go back to basics, strip it back, and do what they did in their title-winning season when they just blitzed City on the counter-attack. Yep. Obviously, they don't have Mahrez as that option, but they still have plenty of pace up there. And in Maddison, they've got a ball player that they didn't have in that season. So
the thing with the diamond is, actually, Jake brings up a good point, is you can basically either isolate Jamie Vardy on John Stones.
Yeah.
And that's just...
That's what I mean, is if you even if Vardy could do it on his own, just by having another striker... Same as Man United had Martial or Rashford and James, really, and then they had sort of someone link it.
The concern with that is if you do play the two of them, you'd still want Ian Acho to drift out and cover out wide. And does he have the
cover who? Because the City fullbacks aren't affecting attacking play right now.
Well, Angelino started last night, didn't he? So maybe Mendy will play on
amazing
on
cross
Saturday.
From Angelino for one of Sterling's tap-ins. And also, we should say that Man City, despite going through that final... again, Opta coming up clutch, as they often do. Oxford produced 18 shots, which is the most faced ever under Guardiola for Man City.
I mean...
Which was, again, Carabao Cup, maybe it was a bit lax, but... Yeah.
And Bravo saved some of them. That was the
amazing
thing. If Oxford are getting 18 shots away...
Yeah, I just think Leicester are going to run riot. I think they're going to win by more than one goal. I just think it's going to be...
Notes for... triple at
this
the
is
going
to be Pimpsqueak taking on most predictions. I reckon...
We
said that when he said Man United would win.
That's true.
I reckon City are going to... Leicester are going to win like 3-1. I reckon
Man City
two
are awesome
3-1.
At the Etihad as well.
They're an amazing side, but they're just not right now. Maybe it'll be 4-2, 3-2. I think they're going to concede...
That'll be throwback to Pep season.
Then they're
going to
concede...
Hat-trick.
Yeah, they're going to concede a lot of goals, man. They're
one
just
thing,
not
though,
right.
Here we
Leicester
go.
Played pretty much their full strength team on Wednesday, didn't they? They rested Soyuncu. I think he was the only one. Whereas City rested all the big hitters apart from Sterling. De Bruyne didn't play.
Yeah, I guess.
Silva didn't play. They rested Fernandinho and Otamendi will probably start.
I suppose the one chance City have. I mean, a funny thing is, even if they win, they can't go above Leicester. That's hilarious, by the way. But the one thing they have, the chances they have, if Guardiola is very smart and plays the same sort of team where De Bruyne is in the forward line rather than De Bruyne is in midfield. Oh. If he's smart enough to do that, there's a chance, because then you have Gundogan and Rodri in midfield to hold. But I don't think he will. I think he's going to go try and
outplay. It's kind of bittersweet watching De Bruyne last week, because you're like, why can't he just play that far forward every? Why can't he play that far forward every
just
game?
Drifting. And so also, good. Again, throwing back to a prediction that I wasn't on to defend. One goal from outside the box. I thought he was going to do exactly that against Man United, and he didn't, and they lost. So I got it wrong. Yeah. So you think Leicester are going to win? Do you have a what was it? 3-2?
3-1, 3-2, or 4-2? Pick one of them. I don't know.
Let's just
say
them all in.
Let's say 3-2. Let's say 3-2 for completion's sake.
And the final one, we've already alluded to a potential new manager for one of the teams.
Yeah.
Everton versus... I've spoiled it. I've let everyone else choose.
That's okay.
It.
Don't worry.
But I was so excited because this is the one I'm definitely going to be watching
this
weekend.
This one.
Everton versus Arsenal had the potential to have two new managers in the dugout. Doesn't quite look like they're going to be over the line.
So we saw today that Lundberg's press conference was postponed to tomorrow, which suggests a little Arteta factor playing a role there. The thing is, for Arteta to be in the dugout for this game, you would need him basically to be appointed tomorrow, because that Friday training session, if he can't run that, then what's the point? You might as well just wait until afterwards. The Ancelotti to Everton reports seem to suggest that that's not going to come in for this game. Duncan Ferguson's expected to be in the dugout for this one. The
interim derby.
So in any case, this is going to be interesting to watch, because it'll either be two interim coaches taking charge of their final Premier League games of their respective clubs, or two new managers coming in, or a combination of the two things.
In the stands. Arteta and Ancelotti next to each other in the stands. What would you have done here, Carlo?
Which is fair a thought for us, because it makes it a really difficult game to preview for that reason.
But we're asking you to do it anyway.
So I'm going to operate under the assumption that Arteta will be in and Duncan Ferguson will be his counterpart.
Okay.
And in terms of what kind of game I expect, over the two Premier League game weeks since Duncan Ferguson was made interim manager of Everton, who's attempted the most tackles in the competition? The competition being the Premier League. The answer is Everton.
I was going to say that's a pretty...
And by some distance as well, they've made 57... which is 13 more than the next best total of 44, which belongs to West Ham. That stat will capture the imagination because of the kind of character Ferguson was on the pitch. And to add a little context, though, they've averaged 32% possession in those two games, which they played against big opposition in Chelsea and Manchester United.
I'm only wincing because that means that tackles per... If I was clever enough to do a possession adjusted metric,
right? Okay, so
I imagine it would be very high.
But I can adjust that, because I mean, so that's the second lowest total of possession in those two games in the division. But then again, only Bournemouth are the team below them, and they've played Liverpool and Chelsea, and they've only made 19 tackles. So those two things, which you presume might have a relationship, don't necessarily play out the way. Deep. And it is only two games anyway.
Yeah. Bournemouth sat in their box against Chelsea, which means you don't have to tackle.
Here's another pop quiz question, though.
Yes.
Over the two Premier League game weeks since Ferguson was made Everton manager on an interim basis, who do we think has conceded the most fouls?
Everton.
No.
Oh.
Way too obvious. The answer is Manchester City with 34. Arsenal were second bottom of this order with 15. And if Mikel Arteta is in there and has been able to have some kind of influence over his players in
the Friday training
game.
Session. Kick
in! Schooled in the dark arts of tactical fouling under Guardiola, I expect that total is going to get shot in the arm somewhat.
Which Freddie Lundberg was jealous of as well.
Yeah.
In his post-match, he said, we need to learn from their cynical play, which he said was intelligent. I think he just admitted.
Yeah, no, he was...
And from someone that, again, was there watching Arsenal let Man City walk past them, and then whenever we did counter-attack, Pepe was fouled six times that game. because Man City just kicked him in the air and he was our only transition threat. Yeah. And we didn't touch any of their players, and De Bruyne had the best game of his life because of it.
Even putting aside all that, effectively, in one corner you'll have an Everton team that's going to be like turbocharged by emotion. Like Ferguson had tears in his eyes when he was talking about his job as Everton manager.
I think he's the best interim manager ever.
So this is his send-off, and he hugged the same ball boy, I think, when Leighton Baines scored that like stoppage time equaliser.
It's probably on rotation. win a hug from Duncan Ferguson.
I think that just ball hope boy Everton was, score. I think that ball boy was just trying his luck again, and he knows where to run.
Straight to Duncan Ferguson.
He anticipated Ferguson's run quite nicely. Got in front of him. And then in the other, you'll have an Arsenal team under pressure to show they really care, because that seems to be the criticism that constantly gets levelled against Arsenal, is they're not showing enough effort. You know, you can judge way up the
at the moment, it's
that,
just but genuine ability.
Yeah, I think but it is a perception they should want to combat. And I think those two things will inform the kind of game we're going to see, which is like a sort of quite emotionally charged game in which there are a fair few fouls, fair few tackles. Results wise, I think we're going to see a 1-1 draw in which Arsenal score late, because Everton are kings of conceding late goals this season. According to soccerstats.com, no Premier League team has conceded more times than they have in the final 15 minutes of games this season. Their total is 9, which is jointly shared with another club who I can't quite remember, but recent examples include Mason Greenwood's equaliser, Gini Wijnaldum's 90th minute goal to make it 5-2 in the Merseyside derby. which obviously didn't affect the result an awful lot, but I think it established it as the first time they'd conceded five for a certain amount of years, so not good conceding that one. Kelechi Iheanacho, stoppage time winner, 2-1 loss to Leicester. Lucas Digne in goal, 3-2 defeat to Brighton. Plus, the other side of this, by the way, is only Leicester City have won more points from losing positions in the Premier League this season than Arsenal, who are 10. So in football terms,
in losing positions in the first place.
Yeah, I think most of those points will have been won, but Arsenal seemed to go through quite a streak early on in the season when Aubameyang was coming back. So
Aubameyang was just on a mission, wasn't
Aston Villa, 3-2.
So in betball speak, the prediction I'm making for this week's my singular prediction is Arsenal to score last.
Ooh, interesting. Yeah. One little point I wanted to make quickly on Arteta potentially, just for a bit of analysis on that potential move, is this could be a lot of people. I've seen a lot of tweets being like, who's the one player that could be revived under Arteta? So I thought I'd quickly answer it. And given how Man City deploy Kyle Walker as a fullback, in which in possession, and again, watching this in their recent win at the Emirates, just plays in centre midfield when they have the ball. Ainsley Maitland-Niles is a player that has frequently said he does not enjoy playing at fullback and wants to be a centre midfielder.
And has frequently looked like he does not
enjoy playing, which he did look against Man City. However, this could be the meeting of minds that is needed for his career to take a boost, because he is best at fullback still, I think. I think the games that he's played in midfield, maybe it's born out of apathy of always playing, so when he gets played there, instincts are gone. But at his best, and in the win against Newcastle in the first game of the season, he was very good at fullback. So if Arteta comes in and says, Ainsley, right, let's meet here in the middle, as I said, you're going to be playing fullback, but when we've got the ball, you actually almost get to play in midfield. So if Ainsley Maitland-Niles gets tested there, because Bellerin's fitness is still in doubt, we don't know what's happening, that plays as many games as he doesn't recently, Ainsley Maitland-Niles has a chance to really have one final go at committing himself as an Arsenal player in this potential new right back role. And obviously that is assuming that Arteta employs a similar formation to Guardiola and tactic at Man City. But maybe Arteta has new ideas of his own that we haven't yet seen, and it could be the end for Ainsley Maitland-Niles. But he would be my one player to watch out for in terms of making a big difference in terms of how they're playing now and how they might be playing under a new manager. But we may not see that against Everton, because it'll be too early.
The fortunes of Granit Xhaka are going to be quite informative, because he's a manager who's had, like, similar to Henderson, a lot of fans don't rate him, especially his own fan base. We know this to be true.
Because they booed him off the pitch.
But then behind the scenes, you've had a succession of managers who've all seen leadership qualities and persevered with him. So if he's linked with that January move, most of that comes from the sort of the situation, how Emery dealt with it. So if those links persist, and Arteta's like, yeah, okay, I think he's toast, basically. There's no way back for him with the Arsenal fans. Then we'll know that that's the case, but he could be a player who is revitalised. Because talking of fouling... I think I'm right in saying that Xhaka just
but every other player gets praised for making those fouls,
exactly,
and when he does it, it's like, oh, he can't tackle.
But I think with him, it just looks lazy a lot of the time. Sometimes, because he just gets burst pass and he just turns his leg
out. That's the point.
But that's everyone, exactly what
Fernandinho gets burst pass, but then he just goes yoink.
Yeah, like there was a tackle in the Clásico, to bring it back to that. Longley just body checked.
Moved on from that.
body checked. I think it was Isco. Like, it was being, he got done completely on the halfway. Body checked. It was so cynical. And then the commentator was like, "Yeah, that's the kind of cynical fight you have to do."
Yeah. So if it was going at Xhaka, it was.
It's doing it with more style, isn't it?
Yeah, making it look nice. Arteta's going to teach him the art, as Will said. Dark arts of it. Soon, Granit Xhaka will be tripping people
Torreira,
up, and he won't even know he's done it.
Arteta did it as a player, man.
What you need to do to make it look more like how Fernandinho does it is do it quickly. I think Manchester City have previously had the record for, like, when they lose possession, the amount of average number of seconds before committing a foul was like lowest in the league. So you need to do it quickly, but you need to do it quickly because of all the players around you being so far advanced, and you're kind of there trying to stop a sort of 3-on-2 situation on the counter. So when you make a foul like that, it looks a lot more like, because you can see what the idea behind making that foul was. It was a cynical foul, professional foul, as they call it. So that kind of, you know, colours the perception somewhat. Whereas sometimes Xhaka will do it just when he's sort of being ran out.
Just when he's being not very good. He's not his tackling technique. I think even Wenger said it, is that he's not good at it. So it's just a technical thing which you can learn. You can learn how to tackle.
I think a wider point as well. Arsenal haven't clued into the fact that everyone should be doing it. So Xhaka will make one, and then he won't be able to do another one because he's booked. Yeah. But there's no one else to step in. So like,
and our defenders just run away.
So
at the moment,
like, if you look at the Spurs-Wolves game of the weekend, everyone was like, Adama versus Vertonghen, oh god, that's going to be a bloodbath.
And it Spurs was.
But Spurs had three players booked for fouls on Traore, so it was clearly a Mourinho tactic. Like, okay, you take him, then you take him. He used to do it in the Clásico.
He did it in everything. He did it to Messi, did it to Hazard. You know, just like, oh, just kick him off. So Marcelo kicked Messi, then Pepe, then Ramos, and then with Hazard, it was like Man United.
Herrera chased him around. So if you want to watch a footballing masterclass at the weekend, don't head over to Goodison Park, because there's going to be a clinic in how to kick other players and maybe not get booked for it. But which will result in a 1-1 draw. It might be like El Clasico with more yellow cards and shots on target. Yeah. Maybe foul count will increase. But there you go. Three Premier League games that we've picked out. As I said, we'll be assigning a BetBull single face-off triple header bonanza on the app after the Squawker Talk podcast. And the final bit of today, after this little break, is going to be another bit of fun to do with Flamengo. As is now sometimes the case at the end of the Squawker Talker podcast, we're going to be having just a bit of fun rather than deep diving tactical analysis. And given that Liverpool will face Flamengo in the final of the Club World Cup, we thought you might not know loads about Flamengo. So we're going to teach you some via a game of Would I Lie to You, Dare to Lie to You, not the actual Would I Lie to You name. If you missed it last time, we did it at Brendan Rodgers, and basically we'll go around each guest, and this time I've actually prepared one because I was so jealous of how much fun everyone was having before I've picked one out, and each guest will deliver a statement about Flamengo, to give the Brazilian twang that I'm sure Mo has been practicing as well. Off air, he said it in that way, so I know he's going to be doing proper pronunciation. And then it'll be up to the rest of us to decide whether it is indeed true or false. You get a point if you deceive someone. So you say something that's true, they say it's false. You say false and they believe it to be true. Without further ado, I think I used that earlier in the podcast, maybe. Too many ados. Much ado about Freddy. Nothing. Freddy ado. Mo,
yes.
Drop your statement on Flamengo.
Okay, so when Flamengo signed Garrincha in 1968, fans were so upset at them signing a Botafogo legend, because obviously Garrincha played for Botafogo for years, won the Campeonato Carioca against Flamengo, that they basically they demanded like that they changed their mind, and Flamengo made Garrincha do a public apology, like which he did, and then he played for them, but he didn't play well because he was 38 at the time, and so basically the fans just got, he gave him loads of grief, and then he eventually left after just 1 year.
What are we deciding?
Is that true or false?
Oh.
Have I just lied or not?
I know, but there seemed to be like mini explanations, so I was trying to guess which bit. Ollie?
Sounds true. Sounds too bizarre to make up.
False.
I don't know if... I think the way you explained it sounded like there were facts. True.
It's false.
Ah. Also, what is the...
They signed Garrincha and he played for them and wasn't very good because he was 38 years old. But their fans didn't protest. The fans didn't hate him. It's just the fans were just gone with it.
Oh, you wrote a little short story.
Yes, you did. You delivered it very well, because it sounded like you hadn't read up enough about it, but it was true. And that you sort of just like, oh, I think they did this. So well played. You get 2 points.
Right. Also, we should say no reactions, just a single word answer.
Yep,
because
that's
my
fault.
You influence other people.
Yeah, like you did last week online.
Yeah, we edited that out though, Mo. So our listeners don't know that.
So I'm going to go to the modern day. And also go off the manager, Jorge Jesus, who was afflicted by the Baylor Gutman curse at Benfica, lost 2 European finals with them against Chelsea and Sevilla, 2 Europa League finals. But he finally ended that duck and won the Copa Libertadores in November, with Flamengo beating River Plate 2-1. And my fact is that in doing so, he became the first European manager to win the Copa Libertadores ever. True or false?
False.
Yeah, it's false. I'm pretty sure.
Damn it. Oh, he's the second, isn't he?
He's the second.
Yes.
Any guesses for the first?
No, I can't remember.
A Croatian called Mirko Jozic with Colo Colo in 1991. Ooh. But Jesus is the first European to win with a Brazilian team, but obviously.
No, but that wasn't your fact.
Yeah.
So no points. Unlucky, as Lucas Leiber would say.
Mine is also based on Jorge Jesus. Flamengo manager Jorge Jesus hates Tim Sherwood and once said he has 0 ideas tactically.
I want it to be true.
True.
That is true.
It is true.
I remember
here's
it well.
Here's the full quote. I've got respect for the football club and I've got respect for his players. I have got no respect for the man.
Ooh.
Tottenham were much better under André Villas-Boas and now they have 0 idea tactically. Jesus is apparently good friends with Sherwood's predecessor as Spurs manager, André Villas-Boas, and the feud goes back to when he was managing Benfica during a 3-1 win in the Europa League over Spurs.
Yeah.
The cameras picked up a touchline spat between the pair. And much later in an interview with 442, Jesus explained, he looked at me up and down in the English way as if to say, Portuguesa, your place is there. Stay there, little guy. I understand that look, and he stepped into my zone. That's when I told him to go away, saying, back, 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 but he stayed put. That stayed in my head. And when we scored, I'm not sure why, it was instinctive. I did that little dance as if to say to him, you're taking a hiding and you don't even realise how.
Oh. Sherwood tried to chuck his gilet at him as well.
No,
did it? He loves
that. That's right, probably.
That show was a signature move.
Yeah. Oh my God, the Chile! Right. So no points for you. So I've got to get a clean old sweep here to win. Because I haven't got a tiebreaker.
I have faith in you.
Oh, that sounds right. Despite famously being known as Ojum Negro, which is black and red, Flamengo's original colours, the rowing teams, were actually gold and blue. But it was changed because they were nicknamed the Bottlers after the rowing team did not win a single regatta in their first year.
That is true.
Yeah, I'm going to go true.
False.
It's false, yes. Because they were nicknamed the Bronze Club rather than the Bottlers. But the stuff about their kit is true.
Yeah. See, I knew that was true, but I thought I couldn't remember the last one.
And they were originally founded as a rowing club rather than a football team.
Yeah, I saw that.
And it was only 17 years after it being a rowing club that they played their first football match. But yeah, and then the rowing club wouldn't even let the football team wear red and black for a while. So they had to wear a kite-coloured kit. I basically learned all this from the Historia do Camisa do Flamengo, which was via Wikipedia. But I wanted to use the Portuguese website. So, tiebreaker.
Yeah.
I don't have one prepared. The only things I have prepared, I know the answer to.
No. Well,
so, we'll call it a draw, you know?
Yeah, I like a draw.
One, because Christmas, after all.
Yeah, everyone wins.
And plus, when I say everyone, me and Mo win. It's a squawker special. It's 2-2.
Yes.
So.
Cool, I wish I thought of that. But that is all we've got time for this week. I did.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I wish I thought of it.
You stunned him.
Yeah, you rocked me, and I'm not even going to try and pretend that I did think of it. So, that is the end of it. And, as you may have seen, we are going to soon be recording the Christmas special, which we're going to be talking about Players of the Decade. So, please make sure to rate this episode, listen to it, review us on iTunes, and then join us for it will be released next week, which is a very special episode, as I said, should be a lot of fun. And thank you to everyone that has sent in their Players of the Decade so far. We're going to be discussing them all, as well as our own, so make sure to tune in. And that lets me to say thank you for the guests, for joining me.
Thank you for hosting us, Jake.
Ollie, thank you for coming on.
Cheers,
again.
Cheers, mate. Very enjoyable.
A brace. Of Squawker Talker Princess.
Merci.
Oh, going French after a whole section about Brazilian club. Classic.